Side 10, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings, continuing on page 332. They plodded on, their pace slowed by the need for caution. Great viscous bubbles rose up from the depths of the naphtha sinks around them to pop with odd belching sounds. When they neared the southern end of the bog, they passed the burning pillar, a column of blue flame that roared endlessly as it shot up from the earth. Once they had passed that blazing shaft, the ground began to rise, and they were soon out of the bogs. Perhaps it had been the heat from the burning gases spurting from the earth that made the contrast so noticeable, but when they left the bogs behind, the air seemed much, much colder. "We've got weather coming," Keurig warned. "Rain at first, most likely, but I think there might be snow behind it."
"No trip through the mountains is complete without snow," Ulith observed.
"What are we supposed to look for now?" Tinian asked Sparhawk. "That," Sparhawk replied, pointing at a high cliff with broad yellow bands running diagonally across its face. "Kring gives very good directions." He peered on ahead and saw a tree with a patch of bark slashed away. "Good," he said. "The trail to the pass is marked. Let's ride on before the rain starts." The pass was, in fact, an ancient stream bed. The climate of Eosia had changed over the eons, and as Zamok had grown more and more arid, the stream that had patiently carved the narrow ravine had dried up at its source, leaving a steep gully running back up into the towering cliff. As Keurig had predicted, the rain began in the late afternoon. It was a steady drizzle that dampened everything.
"Sir Sparhawk," Bayret called from the rear, "I think you should take a look at this."
Sparhawk reined in and rode back. "What is it, Bayret?" Bayret pointed toward the west, where the sunset was no more than a lighter shade of gray in the rainy sky. In the center of that lighter spot hovered an amorphous cloud of inky black.
"It's moving the wrong way, Sir Sparhawk," Bayret said. "All the other clouds are moving west. That one's coming east, right toward us. It looks sort of like the cloud those Dawn men were hiding in, doesn't it? The one that's been following us?"
Sparhawk's heart sank.
"It does indeed, Bayret. Sophrenia," he called.
She rode back to join them.
"It's there again," Sparhawk told her, pointing.
"So I see. You didn't expect it just to go away, did you, Sparhawk?"
"I was hoping. Can we do anything?"
"No."
He squared his shoulders.
"We keep going, then," he said.
The steep ravine wound up through the rock, and they followed it slowly as evening began to descend. Then they rounded a sharp bend in the ancient course and saw a rock slide, which was not a slide, strictly speaking, but rather a collapsed wall, a place where the south face of the gap had broken free and fallen into the ravine apparently to block it entirely.
"That's fairly intimidating," Xavier observed.
"I hope Kring gave you good directions, Sparhawk."
"We're supposed to bear to the left here," Sparhawk told them. "We'll find a clump of limbs and logs and brush on the downhill side of the rockfall, right up against the north wall of the ravine. When we pull those out of the way, we'll find a passageway leading under the slide. The Piloi use it when they ride back into Zamok looking for ears."
Colton wiped his face.
"Let's go look," he said. The pile of broken-off trees and tangled brush looked quite natural in the rapidly fading light, and it appeared to be no more than one of those random accumulations of driftwood and debris that washed down every ravine during the spring runoff. Talon dismounted, climbed up a steeply slanted log, and peered into a dark gap in the tangle.
"Hello!"
he shouted into the opening. The sound of his voice returned as a hollow echo.
"Let us know if someone answers," Tinian called to him. "This is it, Sparhawk," the boy said. "There's a large open space behind this pile."
"We may as well get to work, then," Ulith suggested.
He looked up at the rainy, darkening sky.
"We might want to give some thought to spending the night in there," he added. "It's out of the weather, and it's getting dark anyway."
They fashioned yokes from pieces of driftwood and used the pack horses to pull aside the pile of logs and brush.
The mouth of the passageway was triangular, since the outward side leaned against the north face of the ravine. The passage was narrow and smelled musty.
"It's dry," Euleth noted, "and it's out of sight. We could go back in there a ways and build a fire. If we don't dry our clothes off, these mail shirts are going to be solid rust by morning."
"Let's cover this opening first, though," Keurig said. He didn't sound too hopeful about the notion of trying to hide behind a brush pile from the shadowy cloud that had followed them since Thalesia, however. After they had covered the opening, they took torches from one of the packs, lighted them, and followed the narrow passageway 100 yards or so to a place where it widened out.
"Good enough?" Keurig asked.
"At least it's dry," Colton said. He kicked at the sandy floor of the passage, turning up a chunk of bleached wood buried there. "We might even be able to find enough wood for a fire." They set up their camp in the somewhat confined space, and they soon had a small fire going. Talon came back from the passageway on ahead.
"It goes on for another few 100 yards," he reported. "The upper end's blocked with brush the same way the lower one was. Kring's very careful to keep this passage hidden."
"What's the weather like on up ahead?" Keurig asked.
"There's some snow mixed with the rain now, father."
"It looks as if I was right, then. Oh, well, we've all been snowed on before, I guess."
"Whose turn is it to do the cooking?" Colton asked.
"Yours," Euleth told him.
"It can't be mine again already."
"Sorry, but it is."
Grumbling, Colton went to the packs and began to rummage around. The meal consisted of Piloy trail rations, smoked mutton, dark bread, and a thick soup made from dried peas. It was nourishing, but the flavor was hardly spectacular. After they had finished eating, Colton began to clean up. He was gathering their plates when he suddenly stopped.
"Euleth?"
he said suspiciously.
"Yes, Colton."
"In all the time we've been traveling together, I haven't seen you cook more than once or twice."
"Nope, you probably haven't."
"When does your turn come?"
"It doesn't. My job is to keep track of whose turn it is. You wouldn't really expect me to do that and cook too, would you? Fair is fair, after all."
"Who appointed you?"
"I volunteered. Church knights are supposed to do that when unpleasant tasks come up. That's one of the reasons people respect us so much."
They sat around after that, staring moodily into the fire.
"It's days like today that make me wonder why I took up knighting for a career," Tinian said. "I had a chance to go into law when I was younger. I thought it would be boring, so I chose this instead. I wonder why."
There was a general murmur of agreement.
"Gentlemen," Sopranea said, "push this kind of thinking from your minds. I've told you before that if we grow melancholy or fall into despair, we'll be falling right into the hands of our enemies. One dark cloud hanging over our heads is enough. Let's not add clouds of our own making. When the light falters, the darkness wins."
"If you're trying to cheer us up, you're going at it in a strange way, Sophrania," Talon told her. She smiled faintly.
"Perhaps that was a bit dramatic, wasn't it? The point, my dear ones, is that we all have to be very alert. We must be wary of depression, dejection, and above all, melancholy. Melancholy is a form of madness, you know."
"What are we supposed to do?" Colton asked her.
"It's really quite simple, Colton," Euleth said. "You watch Tinian very closely. As soon as he begins behaving like a butterfly, tell Sparhawk about it. I'll watch you for signs of froggishness. Just as soon as you start trying to catch flies with your tongue, I'll know that you're starting to lose your grip on things."
Chapter 24 There were snowflakes the size of half-crowns mixed with the drizzle that swirled down into the narrow pass. Sooty ravens hunched on tree limbs, their feathers wet and their eyes angry. It was the kind of morning that cried out for stout walls, a sturdy roof, and a cheery fire. But those amenities were not available, so Sparhawk and Keurig wormed their way deeper into the juniper thicket and waited.
"Are you sure?" Sparhawk whispered to his squire.
Keurig nodded. "It was definitely smoke, Sparhawk," he replied in a low voice. and somebody was doing a very bad job of frying bacon.
There isn't much we can do but wait, Sparhawk said sourly. I don't want to blunder into anybody.
He tried to shift his position, but he was wedged in between the trunks of two scrubby trees.
What's the matter?
Keurig whispered.
There's water dripping off a limb just over me. It's running down the back of my neck.
Keurig gave him a long, speculative look.
How are you feeling, my lord? He asked.
Wet.
Thanks for asking, though.
You know what I mean. I'm supposed to keep an eye on you. You're the key to this whole business. It doesn't really matter if the rest of us start feeling sorry for ourselves, but if you start having doubts and fears, we're all in trouble.
Sephrania's like a mother hen sometimes. She loves you, Sparhawk. It's only natural for her to be concerned.
I'm a big boy now, Keurig. I'm even married.
Why, I do believe you're right. How strange that I missed that.
Very funny.
They waited, straining their ears, but all they could hear was the sound of water dripping from tree limbs.
Sparhawk, Keurig said finally.
Yes?
If something happens to me, you'll look after Aslati, won't you? And the boys?
Nothing's going to happen to you, Keurig.
Probably not, but I need to know anyway.
You've got a pension coming. Quite a sizable one, actually. I may have to sell off some acreage to cover it. Aslati will be well taken care of.
That's assuming you survive this trip as well, Keurig said wryly.
You don't have to worry about that, my friend. It's in my will. Vanion will see to it, or Elana.
You think of everything, don't you, Sparhawk? I'm in a dangerous line of work. I'm sort of obliged to make provisions, just in case of accidents.
Sparhawk grinned at his friend.
Is this particular subject designed to cheer me up in some obscure way? He asked.
I just wanted to know, that's all, Keurig said.
It's good to have your mind at rest about such things.
Aslati should be able to set the boys up in trades of their own, then.
Your boys already have a trade, Keurig.
Farming?
Sometimes that's a little dubious.
I wasn't talking about farming.
I've talked with Vanion about them. Your oldest boy's probably going to be entering his novitiate when this business is all over.
That's ridiculous, Sparhawk.
Not really. The Pandion Order always needs good men. And if they're at all like their father, your sons are some of the best. We'd have had you knighted years ago, but you wouldn't even let me talk about it. You're a stubborn man, Keurig.
Sparhawk, you...
Keurig broke off.
Somebody's coming, he hissed.
This is pure idiocy, a voice from the other side of the thicket said in the crude mixture of Aline and Styric that identified the speaker as Azamok.
What did he say? Keurig whispered. I can't follow that gibberish.
I'll tell you later.
Why don't you go back and tell Sir Kel that he's an idiot, Huna? The other voice suggested. I'm sure he'll be very interested in your opinion.
Sir Kel is an idiot, Timok. He's from Karakak. They're all either insane or feeble-minded there.
Our orders come from Otha, not from Sir Kel, Huna, Timok said.
Sir Kel's just doing what he's told to do.
Otha, Huna snorted. I don't believe there is an Otha. The priesthood just made him up. Who's ever seen him?
You're lucky I'm your friend, Huna. You could get yourself fed to the vultures for that kind of talk.
Stop complaining so much. This isn't so bad. All we have to do is ride around looking for people in the countryside where there aren't any people. They've all been rounded up and sent off to Lammerkand already.
I'm tired of all the rain, that's all.
Be glad it's only raining water, Huna. When our friends encounter the church knights on the plains of Lammerkand, they'll probably run into cloudbursts of fire. Or lightning, or poisonous snakes.
The church knights can't be that bad, Huna scoffed. We've got Azash to protect us.
Some protection, Timok sneered. Azash boils Zamok babies down for soup stock.
That's superstitious nonsense, Timok.
Have you ever known anybody who went to his temple and came back? A shrill whistle came from some distance off.
"That's Sir Kell," Timok said. "It's time to move on, I guess. I wonder if he knows how irritating that whistling is."
"He has to whistle, Timok.
He hasn't learned how to talk yet. Let's go."
"What did they say?" Kurik whispered. "Who are they?"
"They seem to be part of a patrol of some kind," Sparhawk replied.
"Looking for us? Did Martell manage to send people out in spite of everything?"
"I don't think so. From what those two said, they're out to round up everybody who hasn't gone off to war. Let's gather up the others and move on."
"What were they saying?" Carlton asked as they set out again.
"They were complaining," Sparhawk said. "They sounded like soldiers the whole world over. I think if we push aside all these horror stories, we'll find that Zamoks aren't really all that much different from common people anywhere else."
"They worship Azash," Xavier said stubbornly. "That makes them monsters by definition."
"They fear Azash, Xavier," Sparhawk corrected. "There's a difference between fear and worship. I don't really think we need to embark on a war of total annihilation here in Zamok. We need to clean out the fanatics and the elite troops, along with Azash and Otha, of course. After that, I think we can leave the common people alone to pick out their own theology, whether it's Aline or Styrek."
"They're a degenerate race, Sparhawk," Xavier insisted stubbornly. "The intermarriage of Styrek and Aline is an abomination in the eyes of God."
Sparhawk sighed. Xavier was an arch-conservative, and nothing would be gained by arguing with him. "We can sort all that out after the war, I think," he said. "It's safe enough to ride on now. Let's keep our eyes open, but I don't think we'll have to try to sneak through the countryside." They remounted and rode on up out of the pass onto a hilly plateau dotted here and there with groves of trees. The rain continued to fall, and the large wet snowflakes mingled with it grew thicker as they continued eastward. They camped that night in a grove of spruce trees, and their fire, fed by damp twigs and branches, was small and sickly. They awoke the following morning to find the plateau covered with wet, slushy snow to a depth of perhaps 3 inches.
"It's time for a decision, Sparhawk," Kurik said, looking out at the still-falling snow.
"Oh? We can keep trying to follow this trail, which isn't very well marked to begin with and will probably disappear altogether in about an hour. Or we can strike out to the north. We could be on the Vileta Road by noon."
"You have a certain preference, I gather?"
"You could say that, yes. I don't fancy wandering around in strange country trying to find a trail that might not even lead to where we want to go."
"All right then, Kurik," Sparhawk said. "Since you're so keen on this, we'll do it your way. All I was really concerned about was getting through the border country where Martell was planning to leave ambushes in our path anyway."
"We'll lose half a day," Ulith pointed out.
"We'll lose a lot more if we get turned around in these mountains," Sparhawk replied. "We don't have any specific appointment with Azash. He'll welcome us any time we get there."
They rode north through the slushy snow with the thickly falling flakes and the mist that accompanied them obscuring nearby hills. The wet snow plastered itself against them in sodden blankets, and their discomfort added to their gloom. Neither Ulith nor Tinian could lighten the mood with their few tentative efforts at humor, and after a while they rode in silence, each sunk in moody melancholy. As Kurik had predicted, they reached the Vileta Road about midday, and turned east again. There was no evidence that the road had been traveled since the snow had begun to fall. Evening was undefined on that snow-clogged day, a gradual darkening of the pervading gloom. They took shelter for the night in an ancient, decrepit barn, and as they always did in hostile country, they took turns standing watch. They bypassed Vileta late the following day. There was nothing in the town they wanted anyway, and there was no point in taking chances.
"Deserted," Kurik said shortly as they rode past the town.
"How do you know that?"
Carlton asked him.
"No smoke. The weather's chilly and it's still snowing. They'd have fires going."
"Oh. I wonder if they forgot anything when they left," Talon said, his eyes bright.
"Never mind," Kurik told him flatly.
The snow abated somewhat the following day, and their mood noticeably brightened. But when they awoke the morning after that, it was snowing again, and their spirits plummeted once more. "Why are we doing this, Sparhawk?" Calton asked morosely toward the end of the day. "Why does it have to be us?"
"Because we're church knights."
"There are other church knights, you know. Haven't we done enough already?"
"Do you want to go back? I didn't ask you, any of you, to come along, you know."
Calton shook his head. "No, of course not. I don't know what came over me. Forget I said anything." Sparhawk, however, did not. That evening he drew Sophronia to one side.
"I think we have a problem," he said to her.
"Are you starting to have unusual feelings?" she asked quickly. "Something that may be coming from somewhere outside of yourself?"
"I didn't exactly follow that."
"I think we've all noticed it a few times before. We've all been having these sudden bouts of doubt and depression." She smiled slightly. "That's not really in the character of church knights, you know. Most of the time you're optimistic to the point of insanity. These doubts and gloom are being imposed on us from the outside. Is that the sort of thing you're feeling? Is that the problem?"
"It's not me," he assured her. "I'm feeling a little low, but I think that's just the weather. It's the others I'm talking about. Calton came up to me today, and he was asking me why we had to be the ones to do this."
"Calton would never ask that kind of question.
You usually have to hold him back. But now I think he just wants to pack it all up and go home. If my friends are all feeling this way, why don't I feel it, too?"
She looked out into the still falling snow. Once again he was struck by just how agelessly beautiful she was. "I think he's afraid of you," she said after a while.
"Calton? That's nonsense."
"That's not the one I meant."
"It's Azash who's afraid of you, Sparhawk."
"That's absurd."
"I know.
But I think it's true all the same. Somehow you have more control over Beliom than anyone else has ever had. Not even Gwerig had such absolute power over the stone. That's what Azash is really afraid of. That's why he won't risk confronting you directly. And that's why he's trying to dishearten your friends. He's attacking Calton and Bavier and the others because he's afraid to attack you."
"You too?" he asked her. "Are you in despair too?"
"Of course not."
"Why, of course?"
"It would take too long to explain. I'll take care of this, Sparhawk. Go to bed."
They awoke the following morning to a familiar sound. It was clear and pure, and though the song of the pipes was in a minor key, it seemed filled with an ageless joy. A slow smile came to Sparhawk's lips, and he shook Calton awake.
"We've got company," he said.
Calton sat up quickly, reaching for his sword. And then he heard the sound of the pipes.
"Well now," he grinned, "it's about time. I'll be glad to see her again."
They emerged from the tent and looked around. It was still snowing, and the stubborn mist hung back among the trees. Sophronia and Keurig sat by the small fire in front of her tent.
"Where is she?"
Calton asked, looking out into the settling snow.
"She's here,"
Sophronia said calmly, sipping her tea.
"I can't see her."
"You don't have to, Calton. All you really need to know is that she's here."
"It's not the same, Sophronia."
His voice was just slightly disappointed.
"She finally went and did it, didn't she?"
Keurig laughed.
"Did what?"
Sophronia asked him.
"She poached a group of church knights right out from under the nose of the Aline god."
"Don't be silly, she wouldn't do that."
"Oh, really? Take a look at Calton there. That's the closest thing to adoration I've ever seen on his face. If I put together something that looked like an altar right now, he'd probably genuflect."
"That's nonsense," Calton said, looking slightly embarrassed. "I just like her, that's all. She makes me feel good when she's around."
"Of course," Keurig said skeptically.
"I don't know that we should pursue this line of thought when Bavier joins us," Sophronia cautioned. "Let's not confuse him." The others also emerged from their tents, smiling broadly. Yuleth was actually laughing. Their mood had lightened enormously. The bleak morning seemed almost sunny. Even their horses seemed alert, almost frisky. Sparhawk and Bayrit went to where they were picketed to feed them their morning rations of grain. Theron normally greeted the morning with a flat look of dislike, but on this particular day, the big ugly roan seemed calm, even serene. He was looking intently at a large spreading beech tree. Sparhawk glanced at the tree and then froze. The tree was half concealed by mist, but he seemed to see, quite clearly, the familiar figure of the little girl who had just banished their despair with her joyful song. She appeared to be exactly the same as she had been the first time he had seen her. She sat upon a limb, holding her shepherd's pipes to her lips. The headband of plaited grass encircled her glossy black hair, and she still wore the short belted linen smock, and her grass-stained little feet were crossed at the ankles. Her large dark eyes looked directly at him, and there was the hint of a dimple on each of her cheeks. "Bayrit," Sparhawk said quietly. "Look." The young apprentice turned, and then he suddenly stopped. "Hello, Flute," he greeted her, sounding strangely unsurprised. Afrael blew him a little trill of recognition and continued her song. Then the mist swirled about the tree, and when it cleared, she was no longer there. Her melody, however, continued. "She looks well, doesn't she?" Bayrit said. "How could she look otherwise?" Sparhawk laughed. The days seemed to race by after that. What had been tedious plodding through gloom and snow now took on an almost holiday air. They laughed and joked and even ignored the weather, though it did not noticeably improve. It continued to snow each night and on into the morning, but at about noon each day the snow gradually turned to rain, and the rain melted down each night's accumulation so that although they rode through continual slush, the drifts did not pile up sufficiently to impede their progress. Intermittently, as they rode, the sound of Afrael's pipes hauntingly drifted out of the mist, urging them on. It was several days later when they came over a hill to look down at the lead-gray expanse of the Gulf of Merjuk, stretching before them, half-shrouded by mist and the chill drizzle. Huddled on the near shore was a sizable cluster of low buildings. "That would be all back," Calton said. He wiped at his face and peered down at the town intently. "I don't see any smoke," he noted. "No, wait. There's one live chimney, right near the center of town." "We may as well go down there," Keurig said. "We're going to have to steal a boat." They rode down the hill and entered Allback. The streets were unpaved and clogged with slushy snow. The snow had not been churned into soupy muck, a clear indication that the town was uninhabited. The single column of smoke, thin and sickly-looking, rose from the chimney of a low, shed-like building facing what appeared to be a town square. Yuleth sniffed at the air. "A tavern, judging from the smell," he said. They dismounted and went inside. The room was long and low, with smoke-stained beams and moldy straw on the floor. It was cold and damp and smelled foul. There were no windows, and the only light came from a small fire flickering on a hearth at the far end. A hunchbacked man dressed in rags was kicking a bench to pieces to feed the fire.
"Who's there?"
he cried out as they entered.
"Travelers," Sophronia replied in Styric, her tone strangely alien. "We're looking for a place to spend the night."
"Don't look here," the hunchback growled. "This is my place."
He threw several pieces of the bench into the fireplace, pulled a greasy blanket about his shoulders, and sat back down, pulling an open beer keg closer to him, and then extending his hands toward the feeble flames.
"We'll gladly go somewhere else," she said to him. "We need a little information, though."
"Go ask somebody else."
He squinted at her. His eyes were oddly disconnected, looking off in different directions, and he looked to one side of her in that peculiar way of the nearly blind. Sophronia crossed the straw-littered floor and faced the uncivil hunchback.
"You seem to be the only one here,"
she told him.
I am, he said sullenly. All the rest went off to die in Lammerkand. I'll die here. That way I don't have to walk so far. Now get out of here.
She extended her arm and then turned it over in front of his stubbled face. The image of the serpent's head rose from her palm, its tongue flickering. The half-blind hunchback puckered his face, turning his head this way and that, in an effort to see what she was holding. Then he cried out in fright, half-rose, and stumbled back over his stool, spilling his beer keg. You have my permission to offer your greeting, Sophronia said in an implacable tone.
I didn't know who you were, priestess, he gibbered. Forgive me, please.
We'll see. Is there no one else in the town?
None, priestess, only me. I'm too crippled to travel, and I can hardly see. They left me behind.
We seek another group of travelers, four men and a woman. One of the men has white hair. Another looks like an animal. Have you seen them?
Please don't kill me. Then speak. Some people passed through here yesterday. They may have been the ones you're looking for. I can't say for sure, because they didn't come close enough to the fire for me to see their faces. I could hear them talking, though. They said they were going to Akka, and from there to the capital. They stole Tassalk's boat.
The hunchback sat up on the floor, clasped his arms about him, and began to rock back and forth rhythmically, moaning to himself.
He's crazy, Tinian said quietly to Sparhawk.
Yes, Sparhawk agreed sadly.
All gone, the hunchback crooned. All gone off to die for Azash. Kill the Alenes, then die. Azash loves death. All die. All die. All die for Azash.
We're going to take a boat, Sophronia cut through his ravings.
Take, take. Nobody will come back. All die, and Azash will eat them.
Sophronia turned her back on him and returned to where the others stood. We'll leave here now, she said in a steely tone.
What's going to happen to him? Talon asked her, his voice subdued. He's all by himself here, and nearly blind.
He'll die, she replied in an abrupt tone of voice.
All alone?
Talon's voice was half sick.
Everybody dies alone, Talon.
She resolutely led them from the stinking tavern. Once she was outside, however, she broke down and wept. Sparhawk went to his saddlebags and took out his map. He studied it with a frown. Why would Martell go to Akka? He muttered to Tinian. It's leagues out of his way.
There's a road from Akka to Zamok, Tinian said, pointing at the map. We've been pushing him hard, and his horses are probably nearly exhausted.
Maybe that's it, Sparhawk agreed, and Martell's never been very fond of going across country.
Will we follow the same route?
I don't think so. He doesn't know much about boats, so he'll wallow around out there in the gulf for several days. Curic's a sailor, though, so he can take us straight across. We should be able to make it from the east shore to the capital in about 3 days. We can still get there before he does. Curic, he called. Let's go find a boat.
Sparhawk was leaning against the rail of the large tar-smeared scow Curic had selected. The surface winds had swung briefly around to the west, and their ship sped across the choppy waters of the gulf toward the east. Sparhawk reached inside his tunic and took out Alana's letter.
Beloved,
if all has gone well, you're very close to the Zamok border by now, and I must believe that all has gone well, or else I shall go mad. You and your companions will succeed, dearest Sparhawk. I know that, as surely as if God himself had told it to me. Our lives are strangely controlled, my love. We were destined to love each other and to marry. We had no real choice in this, I think, though I would certainly have chosen no other. Our meeting each other and our marriage were all a part of some grander design, even as was the gathering of your companions. Who in all the world could be more perfectly suited to aid you than the great men who ride with you? Colton and Curic, Tinian and Ulith, Bavier and dear Bayrit, so young and so very brave. All of them have joined with you in love and common purpose.
You surely cannot fail, my beloved, not with such men at your side. Hasten, my champion and husband. Take your invincible companions to the lair of our ancient foe and confront him there. Let Azash tremble, for the knight Sparhawk comes with Beliom in his fist, and not all the powers of hell can prevail against him. Hasten, my beloved, and know that you are armed not merely with Beliom, but with my love as well. I love you, Elana.
Sparhawk read through the letter several times. His bride, he saw, had a very strong tendency toward oratory. Even her letters had the tone of a public address. Stirring though the message was, he might have preferred something a bit less polished, something more genuine. Although he knew that the emotions she expressed came from her heart, her fondness for the well-turned phrase somehow intruded itself between them. "Oh, well," he sighed. "She'll probably relax as we get to know each other better." Then Beirut came up on deck, and Sparhawk remembered something. He read through the letter again and made a quick decision. "Beirut," he called, "do you suppose I could have a word with you?"
"Of course, Sir Sparhawk."
"I thought you might like to see this." Sparhawk handed him the letter. Beirut looked at it.
"But this is personal, Sir Sparhawk," he objected.
"It concerns you, I think. It may help you to deal with the problem you've been having lately." Beirut read through the letter, and a strange expression came over his face. "Does that help at all?" Sparhawk asked him. Beirut flushed.
You knew?" he stammered.
Sparhawk smiled a bit wryly. "I know it may be hard for you to believe, my friend, but I was young once myself. What's happened to you has probably happened to every young man who's ever lived. In my case, it was when I first went to court. She was a young noblewoman, and I was absolutely certain that the sun rose and set in her eyes. I still think of her on occasion, rather fondly, actually. She's older now, of course, but her eyes still make me weak when she looks at me."
"But you're married, Sir Sparhawk."
"That's fairly recent, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with what I felt for that young noblewoman. You'll waste a lot of dreams on Elana, I expect. We all do that in these cases, but maybe it makes better men of us."
"Surely you won't tell the Queen?"
Beirut seemed shocked. "Probably not, no. It doesn't really concern her, so why should I worry her about it? The point I'm trying to make here, Beirut, is that what you're feeling is a part of growing up. Everybody goes through the same thing, if he's lucky."
"You don't hate me then, Sir Sparhawk?"
"Hate you? God, no, Beirut. I'd be disappointed in you if you didn't feel this way about some young pretty girl." Beirut sighed.
"Thank you, Sir Sparhawk," he said.
"Beirut, before very long you're going to be a full-fledged Pandion knight, and then we'll be brothers. Do you suppose we could drop that, sir? Just Sparhawk will do. I more or less recognize the name."
"If you wish, Sparhawk," Beirut said.
He offered his friend the letter. "Why don't you keep it for me? I've got a lot of clutter in my saddlebags, and I wouldn't want to lose it." Then the two of them, their shoulders almost touching, went aft to see if Keurig needed any help with the ship. They rigged a sea anchor that evening, and when they awoke the following morning, they found that the rain and snow had passed, though the sky was still lead gray.
"That cloud's there again, Sparhawk," Beirut reported, coming forward from the stern. "It's a good long ways behind us, but it's definitely there."
Sparhawk looked aft. Now that he could actually see it, it did not seem quite so menacing. When it had been that vague shadow hovering always at the very edge of his vision, it had filled him with an unnamed dread. Now he had to be very careful not to think of it as little more than some minor annoyance. It was still dangerous, after all. A faint smile touched his lips. It appeared that even a god could blunder, could push something past the point of effectiveness.
"Why don't you just dissolve that thing with the Beliom, Sparhawk?" Carlton asked irritably.
"Because it would just form up again. Why waste the effort?"
"You aren't going to do anything about it, then?"
"Of course I am."
"What?"
"I'm going to ignore it."
About mid-morning, they landed on a snowy beach, waded the horses ashore, and set the boat adrift. Then they mounted and rowed inland. The eastern side of the gulf was far more arid than the mountains to the west had been, and the rocky hills were covered with a layer of fine black sand, thinly dusted in sheltered spots with skiffs of powdery snow. The wind was bitingly cold, and it lifted clouds of dust and snow to engulf them as they pushed on. They rode through what seemed a perpetual twilight, their mouths and noses covered with scarves.
"Slow going," Euloth observed laconically, carefully wiping dust from his eyes. "Martell's decision to go by way of Akka might have been wise.
I'm sure it's just as cold and dusty on the road from Akka to Zamok," Sparhawk said. He smiled faintly. "Martell's a fastidious sort. He absolutely abhors getting dirty. The notion of a couple of pounds of fine black sand mixed with snow sifting down the back of his neck sort of appeals to me for some reason."
"That's very petty, Sparhawk," Sophrania chided.
"I know," he replied. "I'm like that sometimes." They took shelter that night in a cave, and when they emerged the following morning, they found that the sky had cleared, although the wind had picked up and was stirring up clouds of the perpetual dust. Beirut was the sort of young man who took his responsibilities very seriously. He had taken it upon himself to scout around at first light, and he was just returning as the rest of them gathered at the cave mouth. They could clearly see his look of revulsion as he came nearer.
"There are some people out there, Sparhawk," he said as he dismounted.
"Soldiers?"
"No. They have old people and women and children with them. They have a few weapons, but they don't seem to know how to handle them."
"What are they doing?" Carlton asked. Beirut coughed nervously and looked around.
"I'd really rather not say, Sir Carlton, and I don't think we want Lady Sophrania to see them. They've set up a sort of an altar with a clay idol on it, and they're doing things people shouldn't do in public. I think they're just a group of degenerate peasants."
"We'd better tell Sophrania," Sparhawk decided.
"I couldn't do that, Sparhawk," Beirut said, blushing. "I couldn't describe what they're doing in front of her."
"Generalize, Beirut. You don't have to be too specific."
Sophrania, however, proved to be curious. "Exactly what are they doing, Beirut?"
"I knew she was going to ask," Beirut muttered reproachfully to Sparhawk.
They're sacrificing animals, Lady Sophrania, and they aren't wearing any clothes, even in this cold. They're smearing blood from the sacrifices on their bodies, and they're,
"Yes," she said, "I'm familiar with the rite. Describe the people. Do they look steric, or are they more lean?"
"Many of them are fair-haired, Lady Sophrania."
"Ah," she said, "that's who they are, then. They don't pose any particular danger. The idol is another matter, though. We can't leave it behind us. We have to smash it."
"For the same reason we had to break the one in the cellar at Gossek?" Carlton asked.
"Exactly." She made a little face. "I shouldn't really say this, but the younger gods blundered when they confined Azash to that clay idol in the shrine near Ganda. The idea was sound enough, but they overlooked something. The idol can be duplicated by men, and if certain rites are performed, the spirit of Azash can enter the duplicates."
"What do we do?" Xavier asked.
"We go smash the idol before the rite's completed."
The unclad Zamoks in the canyon were none too clean, and their hair was tangled and matted. Sparhawk had never truly realized before just how much of human ugliness is concealed by clothing. The naked worshippers appeared to be peasants and herdsmen, and they squealed with fright as the mail-skirted knights burst upon them. The fact that the attackers were disguised as Zamoks added to their confusion. They ran this way and that, bawling in terror. Four of their number wore crude ecclesiastical robes, and they stood before the altar where they had just finished sacrificing a goat. Three of them gaped in stunned disbelief at the knights, but the fourth, a scraggly-bearded fellow with a narrow head, was weaving his fingers and speaking desperately in Styric. He released a series of apparitions that were so ineptly formed as to be laughable. The knights rode directly through the apparitions and the milling crowd.
"Defend our god!" the priest shrieked, his lips flecked with foam.
His parishioners, however, chose not to do that. The mud idol on the crude altar seemed to be moving slightly, even as a distant hill seems to dance and waver in the shimmering heat of a summer afternoon. Wave upon wave of sheer malevolence emanated from it, and the air was suddenly deathly cold. Sparhawk suddenly felt his strength draining away, and Farron faltered. Then, the ground before the altar seemed to bulge. Something was stirring beneath the earth, something so dreadful that Sparhawk turned his eyes away in sick revulsion. The ground heaved, and Sparhawk felt cold fear grip his heart. The light began to fade from his eyes. "No!" Sophrania's voice rang out. "Stand firm! It cannot hurt you!" She began to speak rapidly in Styric, then quickly held out her hand. What appeared there glowed brightly and seemed at first no larger than an apple, but as it rose into the air it expanded and grew brighter and brighter, until it was almost as if she had conjured up a small sun to hang in the air before the idol. And that sun brought with it a summer-like warmth that burned away the deathly chill. The ground ceased its restless heaving, and the idol froze, once again becoming motionless. Curic spurred his trembling gelding forward and swung his heavy chain mace once. The grotesque idol shattered beneath the blow, and its shards flew out in all directions. The naked Zamox wailed in absolute despair. Chapter 25 "Round them up, Sparhawk," Sophrania said, looking with a shudder at the naked Zamox, "and please make them put their clothes back on." She looked at the altar. "Talon," she said, "gather up the fragments of the idol. We won't want to leave them here." The boy didn't even argue with her. The rounding up did not take very long. Naked, unarmed people do not customarily resist when mailed men with sharp steel in their hands start giving orders. The priest with the narrow head continued to shriek at them, however, although he was very careful not to give them any other reason to chastise him.
"Apostates!" he howled. "Defilers! I call upon Azash to..."
His words trailed off into a kind of croak, as Sophrania extended her arm and the serpent head reared from her palm, its tongue flickering. He stared at the swaying image of the reptile, his eyes bulging. Then he collapsed and groveled in the dirt before her. Sophrania looked around sternly, and the other Zamox also sank to the ground with a horrified moan.
"Perverted ones!" she snarled at them in the corrupt Zamox dialect. "Your right has been forbidden for centuries. Why have you chosen to disobey mighty Azash?" "Our priests beguiled us, dread priestess," one shaggy-haired fellow gibbered. "They told us that the prohibition of our right was a Styric blasphemy. They said that it was the Styrics in our midst who were leading us away from the true God."
He seemed blind to the fact that Sophrania herself was Styric.
"We are Eline," he said proudly, "and we know that we are the chosen ones."
Sophrania gave the church knights a look that conveyed volumes. Then she looked at the ragtag band of unwashed Elenes groveling before her. She seemed about to speak once, her breath drawn in to deliver a shattering denunciation. Instead, however, she let out the breath, and when she spoke, her voice was clinically detached.
"You have strayed," she told them, "and that makes you unfit to join your countrymen in their holy war. You will return to your homes now. Go back to Merjuk and beyond, and venture no more to this place. Do not go near the temple of Azash, lest he destroy you." "Should we hang our priests?" the shaggy fellow asked her hopefully. "Or burn them, perhaps?" "No. Our God seeks worshippers, not corpses. Henceforth you will devote yourselves to the rites of purification and of reconciliation, and the rites of the seasons only. You are as children, and as children shall you worship. Now go!"
She straightened her arm, and the serpent head emerging from her palm reared up, swelling, growing, and becoming not so much a serpent as a dragon. The dragon roared, and sooty flames shot from its mouth. The Zamox fled. "You should have let them hang that one fellow, at least," Calton said.
"No," she replied. "I just set them on the path of a different religion, and that religion forbids killing."
"They're Elenes, Lady Sophrania," Davier objected. "You should have instructed them to follow the Elene faith."
"'With all its prejudices and inconsistencies, Bavier?' she asked. "'No, I don't think so. I pointed them in a gentler way. "'Talon, have you finished yet? "'I've got all the pieces I could find, Sophrania. "'Bring them along.'
She turned her white palfrey then and led them away from the rude altar. They returned to the cave, gathered up their belongings, and set out again.
"'Where did they come from?' Sparhawk asked Sophrania, as they rode along in the biting cold.
"'Northeastern, Zamok,' she replied, "'from the steppes north of Merjuk. "'They're primitive Alenes who haven't had the benefits of contact with civilized people the way the rest of you have.'
"'Styrix, you mean?'
"'Naturally. What other civilized people are there?'
"'Be nice,' he chided her. She smiled.
The inclusion of orgies in the worship of Azash was a part of Otha's original strategy. It brought in the Alenes. Otha's an Alene himself, and he knows how strong those appetites are in your race. We Styrix have more exotic perversions. Azash really prefers those, but the primitives in the backcountry still hold to the old ways. They're relatively harmless.'
Talon drew in beside them.
"'What do you want me to do with the pieces of that idol?' he asked. "'Throw them away,' she replied. "'One piece every mile or so. Scatter them thoroughly.' "'The rite had already begun, and we don't want someone to gather up the pieces and put them back together again. The cloud's trouble enough. We don't want Azash himself behind us as well.'
"'Amen!' the boy said fervently.
He rode off to one side, stood up in his stirrups, and hurled a fragment of mud some distance away.
"'We're safe, then, aren't we?' Sparhawk said. "'Now that the idol's smashed, I mean, and as soon as Talon finishes scattering it?'
"'Hardly, dear one. That cloud's still there.'
"'But the cloud's never really hurt us, Sophrania. It tried to make us melancholy and afraid, but that's about all, and Flute took care of that for us. If that's the best it can really do, it's not much of a threat.
"'Don't let yourself grow overconfident, Sparhawk,' she warned. "'The cloud, or shadow, whichever it is probably a creature of Azash, and that could make it at least as dangerous as the Damok or the Seeker.'
The countryside did not improve as they rode eastward, nor did the weather. It was bitterly cold, and the billowing clouds of black dust erased the sky. What little vegetation they saw was stunted and sickly. They were following something that sort of looked like a trail, though its drunken meandering suggested wild cattle rather than men. The waterholes were infrequent, and the water in them was ice that had to be melted down to water the horses.
"'Cursed dust!'
Euloth suddenly bellowed at the sky, throwing aside the cloth that covered his mouth and nose.
"'Steady,' Tinian said to him. "'What's the use of all this?'
Euloth demanded, spitting out dust.
"'We can't even tell which way we're going.'
He pulled the cloth back across his face and rode on, muttering to himself. The horses continued to plod on, their hooves kicking up little puffs of frozen dust. The melancholy that had beset them in the mountains lying to the west of the Gulf of Merjuk was obviously returning, and Sparhawk rode on cautiously, watching with chagrin as the mood of his companions rapidly deteriorated, even as he kept a wary eye on nearby ravines and rocky outcrops. Bavier and Tinian were deep in a somber conversation.
"'It is a sin,' Bavier was saying stubbornly. "'To even suggest it is a heresy and a blasphemy. The fathers of the Church have reasoned it out, and reason, coming as it does from God, is of God. Thus God himself tells us that he and he alone is divine.'
"'But,' Tinian began to object,
"'Hear me out, my friend,' Bavier said to him. "'Since God tells us that there are no other divinities, for us to believe otherwise is blackest sin. We are embarked upon a quest founded in childish superstition. The Zamoks are a danger, certainly, but they are a worldly danger, even as the Ashandists. They have no supernatural allies. We are throwing our lives away, searching for a mythical foe who exists only in the diseased imaginations of our heathen enemies.' I will reason with Sparhawk about this presently, and I have no doubt that he can be persuaded to abandon this vain quest.
That might be best, Tinian agreed, albeit somewhat dubiously. The two of them seemed totally unaware that Sparhawk was clearly riding within earshot.
You've got to talk with him, Curic, Colton was saying to Sparhawk's squire. We haven't got a chance in the world.
You tell him, Curate growled. I'm a servant. It's not my place to tell my lord that he's a suicidal madman.
I honestly believe we should slip up behind him and tie him up. I'm not just trying to save my own life, you understand. I'm trying to save his, too.
I feel the same way, Calton.
They're coming, Barrett screamed, pointing at a nearby cloud of swirling dust. Arm yourselves!
The warlike shouts of Sparhawk's friends were shrill, tinged with panic, and their charge had an air of desperation about it. They crashed into the dust cloud, swinging their swords and axes at the unfeeling air.
Help them, Sparhawk!
Talon cried, his voice shrill.
Help them with what?
The monsters! They'll all be killed!
I rather doubt that, Talon,
Sparhawk replied coolly, watching his friends flailing at the dust cloud with their weapons.
They're more than a match for what they're facing.
Talon glared at him for a moment, then rode several yards away, swearing to himself.
I take it that you don't see anything in the dust either,
Sophrania said calmly.
That's all it is, little mother. Just dust.
Let's deal with that right now.
She spoke briefly in Styric, then gestured. The thickly billowing dust cloud seemed to shudder and flinch in upon itself for a moment, and then it gave a long, audible sigh as it slithered to the ground.
Where did they go?
Ulith roared, looking around and brandishing his axe. The others looked equally baffled, and the looks they directed at Sparhawk were darkly suspicious. They avoided him after that, and rode with dark scowls, whispering to each other and frequently casting covert looks at him, looks filled with hostility. They made their night's encampment on the leeward side of a steep bluff where pale, sand-scoured rocks protruded from an unwholesome, diseased-looking bank of leprous clay. Sparhawk cooked their meal, and his friends chose not to linger with him at the fire after the meal, as was customary. He shook his head in disgust and went to his blankets.
"Awaken, Sir Knight, and it please thee." The voice was soft and gentle, and it seemed filled with love. Sparhawk opened his eyes. He found himself in a gaily colored pavilion, and beyond the open tent flap was a broad green meadow, all aswirl with wildflowers. There were trees, ancient and vast, their branches heavy with fragrant blossoms, and beyond the trees lay a sparkling sea of deep, deep blue, bejeweled with the gleams of reflected sunlight. The sky was as no other sky had ever been. It was a rainbow that covered the entire dome of the heavens, blessing all the world beneath. The speaker who had awakened him stood nudging him with her nose, and pawing impatiently at the carpeted floor of the pavilion with one forehoof. She was small for a deer, and her coat was of such dazzling whiteness as to be almost incandescent. Her eyes were large and meltingly brown, and they reflected a docility, a trust, and a sweet nature that tugged at the heart. Her manner, however, was insistent. She most definitely wanted him to get up. "Have I slept over long?" he asked, a bit concerned that he might have offended her. "Thou wert aweary, Sir Knight," she replied automatically, it seemed, coming to his defense even against self-criticism. "Dress thyself with some care," the gentle hind instructed, "for I am bidden to bring thee into the presence of my mistress, who doth rule this realm, and whom all her subjects adore."
Sparhawk fondly stroked her snowy neck, and her great eyes melted with love. He rose and looked to his armor. It was as it should have been, jet black and embossed with silver. He was pleased to note as he drew it on that it had no more weight than gossamer silk. It was not steel, however. Though his great sword was imposing, it was, he knew, no more than ornamental in this fairy kingdom begirt by a jeweled sea and lying in happy contentment beneath its multicolored sky. Here were no dangers, no hate, no discord, and all was abiding peace and love.
"We must hasten," the white deer told him. "Our boat doth await us on yon strand, where wavelets play in wanton abandon in the ever-changing light of our enchanted sky."
She led him with precise and delicate steps into the flower-kissed meadow, a meadow so sweet-smelling as to make the senses swoon. They passed a white tigress lolling indolently upon her back in the warm morning sunlight, as her cubs,
large-footed and awkward, wrestled in the grass nearby in mock ferocity. The white deer paused briefly to nuzzle at the face of the tigress, and she was rewarded by a broad, affectionate swipe of a huge pink tongue that bedampened one side of her snowy face from chin to ear-tip. The flower-tipped grasses bowed before the warm breeze as Sparhawk followed the white deer across the meadow to the blue-tinged shade beneath the ancient trees. Beyond the trees, an alabaster gravel strand sloped gently down to an azure sea, and there awaited them a craft more bird than ship. Slender was her prow, and graceful as the neck of a swan. Two wings of snowy sail rose above her oaken deck, and she tugged at her moorings as if eager to be off. Sparhawk considered the white doe, bent and placing one arm beneath her breast and the other behind her haunch. He lifted her quite easily. She made no effort to struggle, but a momentary alarm showed in her huge eyes. "Calm thyself," he told her. "I do but bear thee unto our waiting ship, that thou wilt encounter no sudden chill from the waters that do stand between us and our craft."
"Thou art kind, gentle knight," she said, trustingly resting her chin upon his shoulder as, with purposeful strides, he waded out into the playful wavelets.
Once they had boarded, their eager craft leaped forward, bravely breasting the waves, and their destination soon emerged before them. It was a small, verdant eyot, crowned with a sacred grove ancient beyond imagining, and Sparhawk could clearly see the gleaming marble columns of a temple beneath those spreading limbs. Other craft, no less graceful than his own and heedless of the vagaries of the wanton breeze, also made their way across that sapphire sea toward the eyot that beckoned to them. And as they stepped out upon a golden strand, Sir Sparhawk recognized the dearly loved faces of his companions. Sir Colton, steadfast and true, Sir Euleth, bull-strong and lion-brave, Sir... Sparhawk half-woke, shaking his head to clear the cobwebs of cloying image and extravagant expression from his mind. Somewhere a tiny foot stamped in exasperation. "That really makes me cross, Sparhawk," a familiar voice scolded him. "Now go back to sleep at once." Slowly, the valiant knights climbed the gentle slope leading to the eyot's grove-crested top, recounting to each other their morning's adventures. Sir Colton was guided by a white badger, Sir Tinian by a white lion, Sir Euleth by a great white bear, and Sir Bavier by a snowy dove. The young knight-to-be, Bayret, was led by a white lamb, Curic by a faithful white hound, and Talon by a mink in ermine coat. Sophrania, clad in white and with her brow encircled by a garland of flowers, awaited them on the marble steps of the temple, and seated quite calmly on the branch of an oak that predated every other living thing, was the queen of this fairy realm, the child goddess Afrael. She wore a gown instead of that rude smock, and her head was crowned with light. The playful subterfuge of the pipes was no longer necessary, and she raised her voice in a clear, pure song of greeting. Then she rose, and walked down through the empty air as calmly as she might have descended a stair. And when she reached the cool, lush grass of the sacred grove, she danced, whirling and laughing among them, bestowing kisses by the score with her bow-like little mouth. Her tiny feet but lightly crushed the soft grass, but Sparhawk immediately saw the source of those greenish stains that had always perplexed him. She even kissed those snowy creatures that had guided the heroes into her exalted presence. The flowery descriptions came into Sparhawk's mind despite his best efforts to keep them out. He groaned inwardly. Afrael imperiously motioned for him to kneel, encircled his neck with her small arms, and kissed him several times. "If you don't stop making fun of me, Sparhawk," she murmured for his ears alone, "I'll strip you of your armor and turn you out to graze with the sheep." "Forgive mine error, divine one," he grinned at her. She laughed and kissed him again. Sophrania had once mentioned the fact that Afrael enjoyed kisses. That did not appear to have changed very much. They breakfasted on fruits unknown to man, then lounged at their ease on the soft grass as birds caroled to them from the limbs of the sacred grove. Then Afrael rose to her feet, and after circling through the group once more for kisses, she spoke to them quite gravely.
"'Though I have been desolate to have been absent from your midst for the past lonely months,' she began, "'I have not summoned ye here solely for this joyful reunion, glad though it makes my heart. "'Ye have gathered at my request, and with my dear sister's aid,' she gave Sophronia a smile of radiant love, "'so that I may impart unto ye certain truths. "'Forgive me that I must touch these truths but lightly, "'for they are the truths of the gods, and are far beyond your grasp, I do fear.' For much as I melt with love for each of ye, I must tell ye not unkindly, that even as I have appeared as a child to ye, so ye now appear to me. Thus I will not assault the outer bounds of your understanding with matters beyond your reach. She looked around at their uncomprehending expressions. What is the matter with you all? She said in exasperation. Sparhawk rose to his feet, crooked a finger at the little goddess, and led her off to one side. What? She demanded crossly. "'Are you in the mood for some advice?' he asked her. "'I'll listen.' Her tone made no promises. "'You're stupefying them with eloquence, Afrael. Colton looks like a poleaxed ox at the moment. "'We're plain men, little goddess. "'You'll have to speak to us plainly if you want us to understand.' She pouted. "'I worked for weeks on that speech, Sparhawk. "'It's a lovely speech, Afrael.' When you tell the other gods about this, and I'm sure you will, recite it to them as if you had delivered it to us verbatim. They'll swoon with delight, I'm sure. For the sake of brevity, this night won't last forever, you know, and for the sake of clarity, give us the abbreviated version. You might consider suspending the these and thous as well. They make you sound as if you're preaching a sermon, and sermons tend to put people to sleep. She pouted slightly. "'Oh, very well, Sparhawk,' she said. "'But you're taking all the fun out of this for me. "'Can you ever forgive me?' "'She stuck her tongue out at him and led him back to rejoin the others. "'This grouchy old bear suggests that I get to the point,' Afrael said, "'giving Sparhawk a sly, sidelong glance. "'He's nice enough as a knight, I suppose, but he's a bit lacking in poetry. "'Very well, then. "'I've asked you to come here so that I can tell you a few things about Beliom.' Why it's so powerful and so very dangerous? She paused, knitting her raven-like brows. Beliom isn't substance, she continued. It's spirit, and it predates the stars. There are many such spirits, and each of them has many attributes. One of the more important attributes is color. You see, what happens is... She looked around at them. Maybe we can save that for some other day, she decided. Anyway... These spirits were cast across the sky so that... She broke off again. This is very difficult, Sophronia, she said in a plaintive little voice. Why must these Alenes be so dense? Because their god chooses not to explain things to them, Afrael, Sophronia told her. He's such an old stick, Afrael said. He makes rules for no reason at all. That's all he ever does, makes rules. He's so tiresome sometimes. Why don't you go on with your story, Afrael? Very well. The child goddess looked at the knights. The spirits have colors, and they have a purpose, she told them. I think you'll have to settle for that at the moment. One of the things they do is to make worlds. Beliom, which isn't its real name, made the blue ones. Seen from afar, this world is blue because of its oceans. Other worlds are red or green or yellow or any of countless other colors. These spirits make worlds by attracting the dust that blows forever through the emptiness, and the dust congeals around them like churned butter. But when Beliom made this world, it made a mistake. There was too much red dust. Beliom's essence is blue, and it can't bear red. But when you gather red dust together, you have... Iron! Tinian exclaimed. And you said they wouldn't understand, Afrael said reproachfully to Sparhawk. She rushed to Tinian and kissed him several times. "'Very well, then,' she said happily. "'Tinian is exactly right. Beliom cannot bear iron because iron is red. To protect itself, it hardened its essence of blue into the sapphire, which Gwerig later carved into the shape of a rose. The iron, the red, congealed around it, and Beliom was trapped within the earth.' They stared at her, still only vaguely comprehending. "'Just make it short.' Sparhawk advised. I am! It's your story, Afrael. He shrugged.
Beliom's been congealed even more because the troll gods are trapped inside it, she continued.
They're what? Sparhawk gasped.
Everybody knows that, Sparhawk. Where do you think Werig hid them from us when we were looking for them?
He uneasily remembered that Beliom and its unwilling inhabitants lay no more than a few inches from his heart.
The point of all this is that Sparhawk has threatened to destroy Beliom, and because he's an Aline knight, he'll probably use his sword, or an axe, or the Spear of Aldreus, or something like that. Something made of steel, which is to say, iron. If he strikes Beliom with something made of steel, he will destroy it. And Beliom and the troll gods are doing everything in their power to keep him from ever coming near enough to Azash for him to be tempted to raise his sword against it. First they tried to attack his mind, and when that didn't work, they began to attack yours. It won't be long, dear ones, before one of you tries to kill him.
Never! Colton half shouted.
If they continue to twist you, it will happen, Colton.
We'll fall on our swords first, Davier declared.
Why on earth would you want to do that? She asked him. All you have to do is confine the jewel in something made of steel. That canvas pouch is marked with the Styric symbols for iron. But Beliom and the troll gods are growing desperate, and symbols aren't enough now. You'll have to use the real thing.
Sparhawk made a sour face, suddenly feeling just a little foolish. I've been thinking all along that the shadow, and now that cloud, had come from Azash, he confessed. Afriel stared at him.
You what?
She exclaimed. It seems sort of logical, he said lamely. Azash has been trying to kill me since this all started.
Why would Azash chase you around with clouds and shadows when he has much more substantial things at his command? Is that the very best all that logic could come up with?
I knew it, Davier exclaimed. I knew we were overlooking something when you first told us about that shadow, Sparhawk. It didn't really have to be Azash after all.
Sparhawk suddenly felt very foolish.
Why is it that I've got so much power over Beliom? He asked her. Because of the rings.
Werig had the rings before I did.
But they were clear stones then. Now they're red with the blood of your family and the blood of Alana's.
Just the color is enough to make it obey me? Afriel stared at him, and then at Sophrenia.
Do you mean they don't know why their blood is red? She asked incredulously. What have you been doing, sister?
It's a difficult concept for them, Afriel. The little goddess stamped away, flinging her arms in the air and muttering Styric words she should not have known existed.
Sparhawk, Sophrenia said calmly, your blood is red because it has iron in it.
It has?
He was stunned.
How's that possible?
Just believe what I say, Sparhawk.
It's those blood-stained rings that gives you so much power over the jewel.
What an amazing thing, he said. Afriel returned then.
Once Beliom is confined in steel, you'll have no further interference from the troll gods, she told them. The rest of you will stop plotting to kill Sparhawk, and you'll all be as one again.
Couldn't you have just told us what to do without all these explanations? Kurik asked her.
These are church knights, Flute. They're used to following orders they don't understand. They almost have to be.
I suppose I could have, she admitted, laying one small hand caressingly on his bearded cheek. But I missed you, all of you, and I wanted you to see the place where I live.
Showing off? He teased her.
Well,
she blushed slightly.
Is that so very, very improper?
It's a lovely island, Flute, and we're proud that you chose to show it to us. She threw her arms about his neck and smothered him with kisses. Her face, Sparhawk noticed, however, was wet with tears as she kissed the gruff squire.
You must return now, she told them, for the night is nearly over. First, however...
The kissing went on for quite some time. When the dark-haired little goddess came to Talon, she brushed her lips lightly against his and then started toward Tinian. She stopped, a speculative look on her face. and then returned to the young thief and did a more complete job on him. When she moved on, she was smiling mysteriously.
"And hath our gentle mistress resolved thy turmoil, Sir Knight?" the snowy hind asked, as the swan-like boat returned the two of them to the alabaster strand where the gaily colored pavilion awaited them.
"I will know that with more certainty when mine eyes again open on the mundane world from which she summoned me, gentle creature," he replied. He found that he could not help himself. The flowery speech came to his lips unbidden. He sighed ruefully. The note of the pipes was slightly discordant, a scolding sort of note.
"And it pleased thee, dear Afriel," he surrendered.
"That's much better, Sparhawk."
The voice was no more than a whisper in his ears. The small white deer led him back to the pavilion, and he lay down again, a strange, bemused drowsiness coming over him.
"Remember me,"
the hind said softly, nuzzling at his cheek.
"I will," he promised, "and gladly, for thy sweet presence doth ease my troubled soul and bids me rest."
And then again he slept. He awoke in an ugly world of black sand and chill blowing dust reeking of things long dead. His hair was clogged with the dust, and it abraded his skin beneath his clothing. What had really awakened him, however, was a small tinking sound, the sound of someone firmly tapping on ringing steel with a small hammer. Despite the turmoil of the previous day, he felt enormously refreshed and at peace with the world. The ringing sound of the hammer stopped, and Curic crossed their dusty campsite with something in his hands. He held it out to Sparhawk.
"What do you think?" he asked. "Will this lock it in?"
What he was holding in his calloused hands was a chainmail pouch. "It's about the best I can do for right now, my lord. I don't have too much steel to work with." Sparhawk took the pouch and looked at his squire.
"You too?" he asked. "You had a dream, too?"
Curic nodded.
"I talked with Sophrenia about it," he said. "We all had the same dream. It wasn't exactly a dream, though. She tried to explain it to me, but she lost me." He paused. "I'm sorry, Sparhawk. I doubted you. Everything seemed so futile and hopeless."
"That was the troll gods, Curic. Let's get Beliom into the steel pouch so that it doesn't happen to you again." He took up the canvas pouch and began to untie the strings.
"Wouldn't it be easier just to leave it inside the canvas sack?" Curic asked.
"It might make it easier to put it into the steel one, but the time's coming when I might have to take it out in a hurry. I don't want any knots getting in my way when Azash is breathing down the back of my neck."
"Sound thinking, my lord."
Sparhawk lifted the sapphire rose in both hands and held it directly in front of his face.
"Blue rose," he said to it in troll. "I am Sparhawk from Elenia. Do you know me?"
The rose flickered sullenly.
"Do you acknowledge my authority?"
The rose grew dark and he could feel its hatred. He inched his right thumb up along his palm and turned the ring on his finger around. Then he held the ring against the flower gem, not the band this time, but the blood-stained stone itself. He pressed his hand firmly against the sapphire rose.
Beliom shrieked, and he could feel it writhing in his hand like a live snake.
He relaxed the pressure slightly. "I'm glad we understand each other," he said. "Hold open the pouch, Curic." There was no resistance. The jewel seemed almost eager to enter its imprisonment.
"Neat," Curic said admiringly as Sparhawk wrapped a strand of soft iron wire around the top of the steel-linked pouch.
"I thought it might be worth a try." Sparhawk grinned.
"Are the others up yet?"
Curic nodded.
"They're standing in line over by the fire. You might give some thought to issuing a general amnesty, Sparhawk. Otherwise they'll fill up half the morning with apologies. Be particularly careful about Bavier. He's been praying since before daylight. It's likely to take him a long time to tell you just how guilty he feels."
"He's a good boy, Curic."
"Of course he is,"
That's part of the problem. Cynic. Curic grinned at him. As the two of them crossed the camp, Curic looked up at the sky.
The wind's died, he observed, and the dust seems to be settling. Do you suppose...
He left it tentative.
Probably, Sparhawk said. It sort of fits together, doesn't it? Well, here goes.
He cleared his throat as he approached his shame-faced friends.
Interesting night, wasn't it? He asked them conversationally. I was really getting attached to that little white deer. She had a cold, wet nose, though.
They laughed, sounding a bit strained.
All right, he said then. Now we know where all the gloom was coming from, and there's not really much point in plowing over it again and again, is there? It was nobody's fault, so why don't we forget about it? We've got more important things to think about right now.
He held up the steel-link pouch.
Here's our blue friend, he told them. I hope it's comfortable in its little iron sack, but comfortable or not, that's where it's going to stay, at least until we need it. Whose turn is it to cook breakfast?
Yours, Euleth told him.
I cooked supper last night.
What's that got to do with it?
That's hardly fair, Euleth.
I just keep track of these things, Sparhawk. If you're interested in justice, go talk with the gods.
The rest of them laughed, and everything was all right again. While Sparhawk was preparing breakfast, Sophrenia joined him at the fire.
I owe you an apology, dear one, she confessed.
Oh?
I didn't even suspect that the troll gods might have been the source of that shadow.
I'd hardly call that your fault, Sophrenia. I was so convinced that it was Azash that I wasn't willing to admit any other possibility.
I'm supposed to know better, Sparhawk. I'm not supposed to rely on logic.
I think it might have been Perrain that led us in the wrong direction, little mother, he said gravely. Those attacks of his came at Martell's direction, and Martell was simply following an earlier strategy laid down by Azash. Since it was just a continuation of what had been going on before, we had no reason to suspect that something new had entered the game. Even after we found out that Perrain had nothing to do with the shadow, the old idea still stuck. Don't blame yourself, Sophrenia, because I certainly don't blame you. What surprises me is that Afrael didn't see that we were making a mistake and warn us about it.
Sophrenia smiled a bit ruefully.
I'm afraid it was because she couldn't believe that we didn't understand. She has no real conception of just how limited we are, Sparhawk.
Shouldn't you tell her?
I'd sooner die.
Curic's speculation may or may not have been correct, but whether that constant wind that had choked them with dust for the past few days had been of natural origin, or whether Beliom had roused it, it was gone now. The air was clear and cold. The sky was bright, brittle, blue, and the sun, cold and hard, hung above the eastern horizon. That, coupled with the vision of the preceding night, lifted their spirits enough to make it even possible for them to ignore the black cloud hovering on the horizon behind them.
Sparhawk, Tinian said, pulling his horse in beside Farron, I think I finally figured it out.
Figured what out?
I think I know how Euleth decides whose turn it is to cook.
Oh? I'd like to hear that.
He just waits until somebody asks, that's all. As soon as somebody asks whose turn it is, Euleth appoints him to do the cooking.
Sparhawk thought back.
You could be right, you know. He agreed. But what if nobody asks?
Then Euleth has to do the cooking himself. It happened once, as I recall.
Sparhawk thought it over.
Why don't you tell the others, he suggested. I think Euleth has a lot of turns coming, don't you?
He does indeed, my friend.
Tinian laughed.
It was about mid-afternoon when they reached a steep ridge of sharply fractured black rock. There was a sort of a trail winding toward its top. When they were about halfway up, Talon called to Sparhawk from the rear.
Why don't we stop here? He suggested. I'll sneak on ahead and take a look.
It's too dangerous. Sparhawk turned him down flatly.
Grow up, Sparhawk. That's what I do. I'm a professional sneak. Nobody's going to see me, I can guarantee that.
The boy paused.
Besides, he added, if there's any kind of trouble, you're going to need grown men wearing steel to help you. I wouldn't be of much use in a fight, so I'm the only one you can really spare. He made a face. I can't believe I just said that. I want you all to promise to keep Afrael away from me. I think she's an unhealthy influence.
Forget it. Sparhawk rejected the idea.
No chance, Sparhawk, the boy said impudently, rolling out of his saddle and hitting the ground running. None of you can catch me.
He's long overdue for a good thrashing, Curic growled as they watched the nimble boy scamper up the side of the ridge.
He's right, though, Colton said. He's the only one we can really afford to lose. Somewhere along the way, he's picked up a fairly wide streak of nobility. You should be proud of him, Curic.
Pride wouldn't do me much good when it came time to try to explain to his mother why I let him get himself killed. Above them, Talon had disappeared almost as if the ground had opened and swallowed him. He emerged several minutes later from a fissure near the top of the ridge and ran back down the trail to rejoin them.
There's a city out there, he reported. It would almost have to be Zamok, wouldn't it?
Sparhawk took his map out of his saddlebag. How big is the city?
About the size of Simara.
It has to be Zamok, then. What does it look like?
I think it was sort of what they had in mind when they invented the word ominous.
Was there any smoke? Curic asked him.
Only coming from the chimneys of a couple of large buildings in the center of the city. They seem to be sort of connected. One of them has all kinds of spires, and the other one's got a big black dome.
The rest of the city must be deserted, Curic said.
Have you ever been in Zamok before, Sophronia? Once.
What's the place with all the spires?
Otha's palace.
And the one with the black dome? Curic did not really have to ask. They all knew the answer.
The building with the black dome is the Temple of Azash. He's there, waiting for us.
Chapter 26 Subterfuge had never really been an option, Sparhawk concluded, as he and his companions put aside their minimal disguises to don their armor. Deceiving unsophisticated peasants and third-rate militiamen out in the countryside was one thing, but attempting to pass unchallenged through a deserted city patrolled by elite troops would have been futile. Ultimately, they would be obliged to resort to force of arms, and under the circumstances that meant full armor. Chainmail was adequate for impromptu social get-togethers in rural surroundings, he thought wryly, but city life required greater formality. Country attire simply would not do.
All right, what's the plan?
Colton asked as the knights helped each other into their armor. I haven't exactly put one together yet, Sparhawk admitted. To be perfectly honest with you, I didn't really think we'd get this far. I thought the best we could hope for was to get close enough to Otha's city to include it in the general destruction when I smashed the Belium. As soon as we get settled into harness, we'll talk with Sophronia. High, thin clouds had begun to drift in from the east during the afternoon, and as the day moved on toward sunset, those clouds began to thicken. The desiccated chill began to lessen, and it was replaced by a peculiar sultriness. There were occasional rumblings of thunder far beyond the eastern horizon when, as the sun was dying amid bloody clouds, the knights gathered around Sophronia.
Our glorious leader here seems to have neglected a few strategic incidentals,
Colton announced to sort of start things off. Be nice, Sparhawk murmured to him.
I am, Sparhawk. I haven't used the word idiot even once. The question that makes us all burn with curiosity is, what do we do now?
Just offhand, I'd say we could rule out a siege, Euleth observed.
Frontal assaults are always fun, Tinian said.
Do you mind? Sparhawk said to them acidly.
This is sort of how I see it, Sophronia. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.